You're listening to today's Boondoggle with your host, the one and only Bill Bailey on Domain Cleveland Radio.
Thank you for tuning into this week's edition of today's Boondoggle. Domain Cleveland Entertainment is a veteran-owned and operated entertainment cornucopia of nonsensical shenanigans. You can find interesting interviews, music news, entertainment information, and just about everything else in between. Thank you again for tuning into the show here at Domain Cleveland.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? It's Bill Bailey with today's Boondoggle on Domain Cleveland Radio, and I'm sitting here with...
This is Scott Caribou Ladd, a.k.a. Starboy Scott.
Hey, Scott, how you doing, buddy?
I'm good. Good to see you. I thank you for giving me this opportunity to...
No, thank you for allowing me in your home so we can do this. I know we talked about it. I mean, it was a while ago
Sure.
when we connected, you know, at my men's recovery group, and you came and spoke to us. And, you know, then I got to hear your testimony then, and then the whole... Revival for Survival
yeah.
show. I got to see you perform with the bike and
yeah.
everything, and then
awesome.
And then share your story again there. And I just knew that I wanted to sit down with you and have give you the opportunity to maybe reach some people that
sure.
weren't there and listen to this podcast.
Sure, you know, that's the main goal in my mission in life now. You know, it's people didn't know when I was back in my heyday, and probably when you and I first met back in the day, you know, that
it's like a blur.
Yeah, right. But what people didn't realize, and it's one thing that I respect very much so today, is you never know what's going on behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And although it looked like I was living this crazy motorcycle rock star lifestyle, like I was burdened beyond belief in my mind, and you know, it just one thing led into another, and you know, left me almost dead, you know, back in 2011.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk about some of that, but first, let's start at the beginning with you. You know, your childhood upbringing.
Yeah.
You know, some of the things that you know kind of started creating you for that. That path that you
sure
were,
you know. I you know, especially now when we do prison ministry and we do a lot of schools and stuff, and what I mean by that is we have this ministry now. It's an outreach
yeah.
slash ministry, and I always joke around, outreaches are usually started by somebody that's failed miserably and then finally got it right. You know, you
yeah.
look at all in a lot of ministries are around the same thing, you know. But anyways, I was blessed as a child, and that's kind of opposite of what a lot of people we deal with. And you know, I was born in the 70s when there was no divorce. And I
yep.
remember I was born in a middle class. My dad was a school teacher. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. But it was simple. It was
mm-hmm.
a simple life. And we didn't have a lot of money, but it didn't matter,
yeah.
right? So
yeah.
I was kind of naive on, you know, what was about to – you know, hit me later on in life.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a lot of people can go back and they try and like, you know, well, it was this happened and that happened. Some of us can have the parents with the best intentions in a normal life, but we just got that thing inside us sometimes that
yeah.
leads us to the wrong path.
And I actually know? Have an answer for that. We'll get to it later.
Okay.
You know, so, and it's interesting because I was born in kind of a church setting, not huge, not a religious family, but
yeah.
And I don't mention the denomination that we were, but I didn't have an understanding of God. I really
yeah.
didn't. My higher power, and they speak about that in a lot of recovery groups, is, you know, my higher power was my family, my dad.
Yeah.
And that's,
yeah.
you know, partially how it should be, you know. But like I said, you know, we grew up in Cuyahoga Falls area, and Dad taught at Walsh Jesuit High School, and man, it was just, you know, I didn't know there was another side of life.
Yeah.
But that was part of the problem. That's why I say you never know, because I realize a lot of kids nowadays and a lot of people were born, and I say right into the lion's mouth, you know, that maybe had an alcoholic mom and no father, right? But it's kind of based off what you said. It's, you know, there's no formula that you can look at a child's life and say, oh, he's going to be, you know, half dead, you know, because it's just like this drug epidemic that Northeast Ohio is in, and Ohio is involved in. You know, it's crossed all the lines, you know, black, white, old, young, rich, poor, it doesn't matter. But so I had a great childhood, almost, you know, too good. And like I said, my family was everything. My friends were everything. I was very fortunate and blessed to have that. I know that, and I appreciate that today. But, you know, as a young teenager, I walked in, and this was my first bout of misery or death or anything. I walked in and watched my dad die. He was only 43 years old. It was unexpected. And, man, like, that was it. That was truly, that was, you know, and I can pinpoint where I went wrong, you know. Some people, it's a gradual thing. And not like as soon as that happened, I really started kind of going down this immediate wrong path. But
the loss of a father figure to mold a young man, you know, it's huge.
Yes. And so
even,
I think.
Even daughters, though, you know, the impact that we have and.
You know? There's a reason why the order of life is mom, dad, child, right? It was never supposed to be just child and mom or child and dad or whatever, you know, what the circumstances are today. So once there's something broken or it just starts broken, two brokens does not make a fixed. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. So for me, it was a slow burn. I know some people, you know, just a traumatic thing happens in their life and they go straight overboard. But for me, it was still, I was just still seeking, you know, this, the peace and the freedom that I lost.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
what became an issue with me.
Okay. So then as time went on, you know, when did you discover that, like, you know, stunt bikes and stuff like that was
your
thing.
Sure, sure. You know? Well, yeah, I was wired with the evil Knievel DNA, you know, but and now I know it was a God gift and talent because I see it in my children now. But anyways, I grew up around motorcycles, you know. I grew up the Easy Rider era, right? Era with you know, just my dad rode a Harley. He rode it to school, and we rode mini bikes, the lawnmower powered mini bikes. And then we had a broken, half broken dirt bike that, because we couldn't afford like a real nice dirt bike. But the pinnacle part of my life was I was 3 years old, and it's crazy because I have a 4 year old now, and this would have been a year ago in his life. I got to see Evel Knievel.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Live, bro. Wow. Right. And I watched, like, this is the monumental day, and it gives me the chills, and you can vouch for the chills. Like, we, you know, mom loaded us up in the station wagon, and my uncle and my dad drove there. My uncle had a chopper, Triumph chopper, 70s chopper, his gangster. And my dad, obviously, was on the Harley. But, you know, he was, that was it. I was looking at my dad and in the back of the station wagon, no seatbelts, whatever, you know. And just kind of watching him, like, this was my real life superhero. It was my father. And then we're going to see Evel Knievel, right? So it's like, it's like this perfect, you know, kind of, you know, perfect storm that's brewing for wiring my brain for what I end up doing for a living. So, you know, we go to Dragway 42, which is not too far from Akron. And it was when Evel Knievel had that huge, it was at the height of his success, but it was also, honestly, the downfall of his mind at the time, you know. But anyways, he flew in on a helicopter, he, you know, his big semi. And for me, as that three-year-old, I just remember, I think my mom was holding me, and I just watched him ride those wheelies with that cape. Between, and the jump was so fast, and it was like, the jump was not what it was. It was the combination of my dad and that wheelie with that cape. I was never a TV kid, a cartoon kid.
Yeah.
That was my superheroes. That's man. That was cape, and there it is. So I went home immediately, and I had this little toddler trike thing, and I started balancing it. So I started, whatever I was on from that time, I was always, so, you know, we had the banana seat bicycles, and I was the wheelie king on that. And then, you know, obviously just graduated to dirt bikes. And then, and you know, when I was in my teen years, old enough to have a motorcycle, that was it, man. I was just hustling. And this was before, you know, everybody knows what a wheelie is now. But back then, you know, it wasn't. It wasn't a sport, or it wasn't really a hobby or anything. It was just, you watched Evel Knievel. It was about the only one that you could watch do a wheelie. But anyways, you know, as soon as I got on that sport bike, man, it was full go.
Nice, nice. Yeah, I remember the banana seat bikes.
Yeah.
And my only, you know, time seeing Evel Knievel was with the TV specials, you know, when he was, I don't know, in Vegas jumping something,
sure,
or whatever like that. I didn't even realize that he did the tours and stuff,
yeah,
like that. That's,
yeah,
pretty sweet.
Yeah.
Can't imagine what that was like. So let's talk about, you know, then as you got older and then you started getting into the motorcycles and everything.
Sure.
You know, it was just kind of, it's still, like, how old were you when your dad passed?
I was 16.
16.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah. So then as you're going on, you know, there's no restraint towards, you know, son, this is how you properly ride.
That's right.
You know?
So once again, I talk about the perfect storm, or I say the stars align for our success as well as they can align for our failure, right?
Yeah.
So here, as a child, they were lining for like the successful and mind-changing and just life-altering experience. But then, you know, it was almost like this perfect storm of, oh my goodness, you know, now I've gotten this machine, I've got this talent developed, but I'm also witnessed my father die. And after my father died, it was like the next 5 years, our whole family was about wiped out, man.
Ooh,
it was,
yeah,
crazy. There was 9 deaths in the next 5 years. So think about it, right? I started riding at 18. So I'm right in the middle of this huge spiritual storm. And just like,
yeah,
and honestly, there was a moment where it was just, I hated God.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, I'm watching my mom. She lost her 2 best friends, her mom, her brother, her husband. You know what I mean? As much as it was hard on me, I couldn't understand if there was a God, how he could do this to,
yeah,
my mom.
Why would he do this to,
right,
you and hurt,
right,
hurt your mother?
Right.
And stuff, and like
it
that
wasn't stopping. So anyways, the more that was happening, I started, you know, I started living this life. You know, people say it's adrenaline junkie. I mean, I get that, but there's a point where I was so on the edge, it was almost like,
you're like, eventually it seems like you're knocking off my family. I'm next. Let me just go. Whatever.
That's it, man. It's, you know, we were talking about that this morning. It's just, it's almost like a suicide mission. Subconsciously, you said, well, this is it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's crazy because if I would have known, if I knew what I knew today, I'd have never done that stuff. Right?
Yeah.
It's great. Because we still do stunt riding and stuff like that. But the stuff I did back then, 150 miles an hour, 130 mile an hour wheelies,
yeah, traffic,
you know, yeah, through
day,
traffic,
yeah,
like every day. I tell my kids it was like 6 days a week, 7 days a week, the police chases. But once again, it was, you know, I say this, when I looked up after all this death and despair was hitting me, and I looked up at God and I said, I'm through with you.
Yeah.
I hate you. The only thing I did that I didn't realize then, but I know now, is I made an open gateway to the devil.
Mm.
Right? So I didn't sign no blood oath. And what a lot of people their misconception of the devil is, he gonna raise you up in the world, right?
Yeah.
And I didn't know the difference between the world and living in the spirit. I didn't really know. I knew God was wanted good, and I really didn't believe in the devil. And I know that's one of his biggest disguises.
His biggest weapons.
Yeah. So, you know, here it wasn't like this Johnny Blaze where he came and cut my hand. I said, I'm going to make you millions of dollars in this. But that's right. But that's what happened, man. So, you know, I was going, and I was primed up. I was going to college. You know, I still had my mom and stuff like that, and my brother. And I didn't have any positive influencers outside of that.
Yeah.
And my mom was too broken. No male. I've had a couple guys try to come in, and this is all meant for a reason.
Yeah.
Because I'd be like, no. And so if some kid says that to me, no, I'm good. I'm like staying. Because I know.
Yeah.
I wish some, and it tears me up. I wish, you know, someone, a mighty man of God, would have broken through to me before I went down the path of hell that I went down, right?
Yeah.
So anyways,
at the same time, it's like that happened to make you who you are today.
And that's another thing, you know what I mean? As much as I wish that I wouldn't, and I tell people this, I wouldn't change a thing, even the point where I looked up and I sold my soul to the devil. And that happened when I said, I hate you, God, I'm through with you. I remember where I was at. I remember when it was. And the funny part about it was, it's not like I got ran over by a bus as soon as I walked outside. I became successful in the world.
Yeah.
I was on magazine covers. You know, we took a simple kind of hobby, but nobody else was doing it in the world. Nobody was doing highway wheelies. I don't know if people know that. It's been so long. But in the mid-90s, we literally like took the motorcycle industry by storm because nobody ever saw kids riding down the freeways balancing it for miles and miles and miles, right?
And that was still before like pretty much the internet.
That was blew up. We didn't even have DVDs.
Yeah.
So that, like, so the younger generation can't even understand that now.
Yeah, so getting that out there and that notoriety and how quick it spread.
I always had the savviness to be a businessman, you know. So, you know, even in high school, I was, you know, making these Scott's Lawn Care Service and stuff like that. But anyway, so once we canned the original film for the FT, our original Starboy movies, that was in 1996. It was big, we called them soccer mom cameras because that's all like big reel-to-reel stuff. We,
oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? People, you have to look it up, man, because it was so long ago. But anyways, I was going to Akron U, and I went down to the edit thing, and I had all this thing. I said, how much would you – it was $500, and he threw this 30-minute video together. And honestly, at that time, I was working like three jobs going to school, but and I had no idea what was about to happen, but we just wanted that VHS because there was a couple bars we used to go to, and people wouldn't believe us. So we set out to kind of – it was a chick magnet thing and a proof, you know, a bar bet thing. So here, suddenly, we're going to the same bar, and oh, no, I don't believe it. You want to – and so we were kind of betting people, I bet you $100. And then we would bring out the video, throw it in, and we made like 20 copies, one for each other and mom. But then as soon as we took it to the bar, man, it was crazy.
Yeah.
It was a once in a lifetime deal. But once again, who was that deal with? But that thing just spread like wildfire. Everybody's like, do you have another copy? And I'm like, we'll have one next week.
Yeah.
So I went and we were dubbing them back then. VHS.
Yeah.
There was two places that did it. There were like a back of the house, and we were paying $9 a copy, right, for a VHS that had a little white sticker on it. And man, the term would be it went viral, man. But this went local viral, you know, and it just went like crazy. And then the motorcycle shows, before we knew it, we were getting royalty checks. You know, we signed a deal with a dirt bike movie distribution company in L.A., and they bought the rights, and they were just sending us checks. I quit my job.
How do you think that reached them? You know,
I sent that to them.
Oh, okay.
You're right. So one of my jobs was, and this is the business savvy.
Yeah.
You know, I knew we had something because locally everybody wanted it.
Yeah.
And back then, they just started the whole dirt bike extreme videos, like Krusty Demons, Moto Triple X. And I'm like, so I looked up, and I used to have to work at a motorcycle shop. So I just looked up, where is this coming from? And I sent two copies out to LA to two different companies. And they called me as soon as it hit the desk.
Wow.
And they were started talking number. I'm like, what is royalty? What are you talking about? So here, I remember hanging up the phone. I was working. They called me at the motorcycle shop. And I called my business. No, they weren't business partners there. They were just friends. I'm like, they want to pay us money for this thing. And it was crazy, man. So you imagine, like, you know, I was in my early 20s. And here, these checks are coming in. And, you know, we start shortly after that. We just start traveling all over the world, you know. And it's just... everybody quit their jobs, and you know, we started starboys.com, and you know, when the internet was available, and you know, people could get their head around it. And
you guys were doing the Evel Knievel tours then.
That's it, man. Wow. It was crazy. Magazines were calling us. We're flying overseas. You know, we obviously had the crazy lifestyle off the bikes, which was just, it was probably more attractive. It was the rock star lifestyle on a motorcycle.
Yeah.
So people were inviting us more, not for the riding, but for the autographs and the party and all that afterwards.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, this is the perfect storm lining up for my disaster. I didn't drink. I didn't never touch drugs. You know what I mean? But I had this huge hole in my soul.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And because the devil was now my chaperone, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
God was always watching out for me. You know, he was always there.
Yeah, you're here.
Yes, for sure. But it's kind of like the Job story. Do your worst. Just don't kill him, right? Yeah. And it was a slow burn. But, you know, the more I obtained, and this is the problem with life, especially with the youth, you think there's an answer behind something materialistic for that hole, right? Yeah. It starts with money. Well, then it starts with, it goes to women. Or once I have a house, this month, you know, and you start reformulating. But the problem is, you know, it's just the devil dragging you by your tail around your life. And every time you get to that, it was, once I have 100 grand, a house, and 3 motorcycles, then I'll have, you know what I mean? Yeah, yeah, and then once I got that, then it was like, okay, well, the answer must be here. And then once I started that, those options I noticed were failing. Two things happened. Number one, I was really searching for an answer. Number two is my soul was even, I was digging it even deeper because I was becoming more hopeless, right? But then I checked in with the doctor, man.
Whew. So during that height of the tours, I'm flying you guys places to do shows and whatever. I mean, do you guys like interact with like the celebrity lifestyle and hang out with
you know,
actual rock stars and stuff like that too?
You know, we would be mixed up all, you know, with a lot of the stars. You know, we would be out in Hollywood, we would be going to Justin Timberlake's bars, and we would be in the hills, and you know, people were wearing our you know, rappers were wearing our like T-shirts, and you know, the FTP logo went a long way.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I, you know, I'm not going to endorse that or even go there, but you know, every one of those shirts I thought was making me money, but it was actually chiseling away at my soul. And that's what I realize now, because some people today, especially, and this doesn't happen often, but with our outreach, we had a challenge with with the sheriff's office up in New York, because they were looking at my past, and they said, we can't endorse somebody that has this in their past. Mm. But I got a chance to go up there and into a press meeting a month before this event was supposed to happen. And I keep it real, man. You know, on October 4th, 2011, at the end of it, and at the end of all those T-shirt sales and all the police chases and all the cops lie shirts that we sold and all the fun and shenanigans that people thought or assumed that I was profiting from. That's what he said. Somebody that profited from, you know, targeting police negatively. And I said, basically, when I couldn't see my two children anymore, my wife was putting a divorce on us and terminating our marriage, and I was looking down a barrel of a gun, getting ready to kill myself. If you, and my kids know that now, they didn't know it then. I said, if you would have went to my wife or my two kids and said, if their dad profited from anything that he did prior to that, would that be a yes or a no? You know? And at that point, there was nothing I profited from that. I sold my soul. And, you know, I always apologize now. And we ended up, you know, we got the message across, you know, and I apologize sincerely to law enforcement and for any, because now it's, now that I have a new set of eyes, it's like, I was justified. Well, at least I'm not robbing banks and not chasing.
Oh, yeah.
We're not, and that's another product of the devil. You know what I mean? I cause major drama, and it's still going on, because now we have the third, fourth generation of Willie riders on these streets, you know. And unfortunately, we started a lot of that in the United States, all the outlaw street riding. You look back, and it goes to the Star Boys in the late 90s, right? So, but did I profit from that? No. You know, once you're working for the wrong guy, everything you make is going to end up being used. Every dollar I made ended up going into my drug habit or my court costs or divorce or whatever it may have been. So I kind of convinced them that I didn't profit from anything I did in my past life.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about that too, as the partying lifestyle picked up, you know, and that just like thinking you're filling that emptiness and just numbing because none of it was enough. I mean, I think I read in one of your old interviews that, I mean, you got arrested on your wedding night.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just, that was where you were at then. It was like the insanity was
that's it.
Control.
You know, unfortunately, when we make that switch just to kind of chase after the world, I think everybody ends up there. Maybe not as bad as I did, but honestly, probably, because people are jumping off bridges and committing suicide or overdosing at a rate nowadays more than any 10 years ago, right? So obviously people are going there. But, you know, and it's the way that the devil really, really makes sure that he secures the deal with our souls, yeah. right? Yeah. You know, by the time you realize that you want out of it, it's too late.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. You're like working for the man for, you know, 15, 20 years. And it's like suddenly you want to, oh, you know, it's kind of like the old gang saying, blood in, blood out. It's like, all right, he's not going to just let you go. You know wow. what I mean? So in that, the way that he keeps those claws in you is through addiction, mm-hmm. right? So it started for me, and this is a long story, but, you know, it started for me with some prescription pills for anti-anxiety. Well, doc, I can't handle, I can't sleep. Lord knows it wasn't because of the 5 arrest cases or all the charges or all the destruction. Yeah. No, that can't possibly be the reason why you can't sleep. Anyways, they don't know that stuff. He just started prescribing me, right? And so anyways, I know that that was the true gateway. And once again, I don't blame my doctor. It was my, and now they're starting to have more. This was a while ago before they really knew the problems that some of those pills were going to cause. The one I was on was probably one of the most toxic, and it was supposed to be regulated, but I took it for 15 years straight, and it was pure rat poison, you know. But anyways, it opened up a whole different dimension of dysfunction in my life, you know. So suddenly my alcohol, my consumption is growing. My tolerances are growing. Obviously, my lifestyle is supporting it because we're going all over the world and hanging out with movie stars and you know, just people are paying us to be the life of the party.
And it's like, you know, you get once you're in enough, they expect it. It's expected of you to be, oh, did you hear this story? What's the story?
Listen, man.
You got to try and keep up that mask.
That's it, you know, and it's crazy because at some point it was when I was truly going through the behind the scenes was horrible. There was a time where I got away with it. You know what I mean? My late 20s, some of the early 30s. But by the time I hit my mid 30s, I was really struggling to get air, you know, but we were down hosting a show in Florida, and I just remember there was a hotline. Everybody was trying to figure out where Scott was partying, right?
No.
I thought it was kind of flattering. It's cool, but now it haunts me, and I get the chills. I'm like, that's, you know, what was attracting and encouraging, and the devil, believe it or not, ends up surrounding you with those that'll keep helping flush your life down the toilet. Right.
Yeah.
And what a lot of people don't understand is that can come with movie stars or ride, you know, motorcycle riders that or anybody, you know, he's going to surround you, your 5 closest friends and your support system for success or dysfunction is going to be appointed by who you're serving. You know, so back then I was paid to go crazier. I had lawyers that were sponsoring us. If you look at some of our old DVDs, there's law firms that sponsor us, right? So think about that. So we're making money. In you know, one of the crazy stories is, and I won't mention names or places, but the first sport bike sponsorship was us, you know, and it was in mid-2000, like 2003, I think. And what people fail to realize is I destroyed a hotel room the night before. And this is where people that are, you never know who's in darkness and who is in light. And this place and these people were in darkness, but very wealthy. Anyways, you'll know by what they're supporting.
Yeah.
So anyways, I destroyed this hotel room. We were getting ready to do a show. The hotel was right across the street. So we didn't have to, they just followed probably the dust trail from the fire extinguishers and stuff. But anyways, they came to arrest us or they could pay the owner, the place that hired us could pay like $2,500 for the damages.
Yeah.
And the part of the story that's even crazier is afterwards, we didn't even know any of this was going down. He sat us down and he said, by the way, this isn't that. And I said, and he was so excited about the whole concept. It was like we were his pocket troublemakers. The part of his life he couldn't live out.
And paying off that. He lived,
and that was it. And he lived through us. I ended up walking. I talked him into sponsoring us 4 brand new bikes. So here, I destroy a hotel room. almost get arrested, do the show, and then talk this guy in because he's so uppity up about just like, God, this is crazy. It's like a movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
And it's almost like,
and he's the producer.
Yeah, and it's almost like, too, you know, you didn't learn consequences for your actions.
We never. And that's the one thing, that is the one thing I preach today, man. The problem with this generation, and one thing that I make sure is, number one, the fear of God. We don't fear God anymore. The kids aren't raised to fear God. The kids don't even know who God is anymore, right? But the other thing is there's no consequences for somebody's poor actions. It's not happening in the schools. You know, it's, I've seen it over and over with my daughter. She's 16. And once again, it never happened in my life. I was actually getting rewarded for misbehaving, which a lot of us are. A lot of kids. It's never, oh, not my Jimmy, not my Franny. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Buy you the new iPhone.
Yeah,
you know?
Here you go. You know what I mean? And it's like, you know, it's this generation that started, I believe, when families started splitting up. Because I saw it when, you know, mom is trying, you know, when mom and dad split up, then, you know, it's like this custody battle.
Yeah.
So they start spoiling. And so the last thing a dad wants to do is like smack, you know, Jimmy on the butt, because then Jimmy's going to go to the mom and, or to the court.
And I only get to see him, you know, on, you know, 1 week in a month or something.
That's
like
it.
That,
and I'm not going to lose that. So I'm going to give him a, you know, go and you punch somebody out at school. I'm going to buy you an ice cream cone, or, you know. Yeah, so anyways, man, we can go on and on about that. But there was never any visible, or, you know, even with the business, we were getting rewarded, we were getting sponsorship, and we just kept, by mid 2000 and 2006, man, we were, I'm not going to mention the numbers, but, you know, we were selling thousands upon thousands of t-shirts, DVDs, and we were sponsored, man. So, you know, but the problem was, I was tied in with the devil so deep that nobody knew. I was this storm that was about to brew. And this is what these stories we hear.
Yeah.
You know, and the artist just blew his head off. Oh, really? How? He had, you know what I mean?
Yeah, or
someone, someone just overdosed. Wow, oh, God, no. It's, you never know what's going on behind the scenes, you know. Anyways, it, you know, I got away with it for a long time. And that's what I say, that's what the devil does. Yeah. It's like a football game. It's like this, the rookie quarterback. He's only got a shelf life so much.
Mm-hmm.
The franchise is going to use him up. You know, and we've heard these stories, and not that I'm against the NFL or anything. Just an example. That's the deal with the devil. He's only going to use you up for so long to do it. And once again, when I started recognizing him and wanted out, and I became a closet case drug addict in this very basement in the corner, you know, he didn't really have much more purpose, especially when my wife filed for divorce, and then I couldn't even come within 500 feet of this place. But he wasn't just going to let me off the hook.
No.
And that comes October 4th, 2011. You know, he drives us, he keeps whispering in that ear. And at this point, I'm 40 years old. I've lost completely everything, including my mind. I'm a full-blown drug addict, every drug. I'm a full-blown alcoholic, right? And I've just paved this path of destruction through this country and through the world of telling people it's okay to break a law that I justified for so long. More than that, I was encouraging people to be just as dysfunctional with drugs and alcohol as myself. Thus, going back to the story of, where's the party at? Find Scott. Then you'll find the party. No, find Scott the morning after.
Yeah. And then just, I mean, even not just the drugs, but the lifestyle riding is like, you know, it, you don't value your life.
No.
You know? What's that, that the kids say, YOLO or whatever stuff today?
And you only live once.
Yeah. And like we talk about with, you know, then it, we didn't discover things into our late teens or something like that, but now it's just like boom, kids are getting cell phones younger.
Talked about that today,
and
man.
Bombarded with these, you know, glorifying these lifestyles.
Kids are fast forwarded into adulthood when they're just still kids.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. And unfortunately, as great as technology is to have, it just helps people fast forward them to places they shouldn't go, because there's a natural order to things, just like we talked about, mom, dad, kid, you know what I mean? There's a grooming, it's like pushing a baby bird out of the house. What happens if the baby falls out because there's nobody watching them up in the nest?
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, in the one thing that I always say is, it's not a, unfortunately, it's not a matter of if, everybody's going to have these challenges, whether you had a great childhood or you didn't, whether you had a great childhood and lost it, or whether whatever. We all have to come to a place, and the place might be tonight. It might be today. For me, it was on October 4th, 2011. That place was seconds away from taking my life. But the fact of the matter is, all that dysfunction in my life was probably the best thing that I did, because it got me to where I finally surrendered. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no.
Right?
It makes complete sense.
So if somebody...
So I wanted to get to, you know, October 4th, 2011.
Yeah.
I mean, where you were at then, when it was finally like, you know, who was it? Jacob wrestled God?
Yeah.
You know, and you finally, it's like, all right.
Yeah.
You know, I'm done wrestling you.
Yeah.
I submit.
Yeah. You know, that... Yeah, that was at that point, though, there was no wrestling, right? There was just and I believe it can come in two forms. Hopefully somebody is wrestling. I was complete atheist at that time.
Yeah.
You know, once I achieved all the success in my late 20s, you know, I think I looked up one more time. I said, you don't exist. I don't need you. Look, I got everything. You know what I mean? And so anyways, that's probably when I walked into the doctor the next day to become a drug addict. But once again... I was a complete atheist, a militant atheist for a long time, you know, especially just because I was arrogant and I was just in a position to
you
be.
You thought you were God.
Yes, yeah, for sure.
You were your own God.
For sure, definitely. And people around me were telling me, you know, that, yeah. That's the problem with fame and fortune, right? So anyways, you know, it was my mid-30s real quick. There was a time I got home from England or something like that, and I have a beautiful wife, beautiful house, beautiful family, two kids at the time, and they were young, and I was a drug addict at that time. Nothing was working. I had gone through 20-some psychiatrists and psychologists. Some of them tried to get me on more drugs, which made me even worse, but once again, I wouldn't take any of that back because they just showed me that there's only one way out of this. Right. And they were just helping me get to that October 4th, whether it was, you know, suicide or not. People be like, wow, I don't ever want to go there. That was the old saying that we hear. The worst day of my life was my best day of my life. So everything wrong that I did that to get me to the point where I was going to commit suicide and make this final decision had to happen. Anyways, 35, sitting on the back deck, beautiful day, just got back. Bank accounts filled. I used to have a safe in this. It's empty now, but I used to have a safe with $100,000 in it, bank accounts, whatever, bikes, multiple houses. And, but I didn't know this, but it was when the devil completely had my soul. And I was sitting on the back patio looking at my wife. My kids were playing in the yard and I couldn't get to them. You know, I couldn't feel them.
Yeah.
Once again, the 70s is just like this comfortable numb. It wasn't comfortable, but there's some songs that try to describe that feeling. It's like there's a, like I was a gorilla with that safety glass between me life, right?
Yeah.
But my safety glass, it was all the condemnation, all the wrong, all the bad. My safety glass was like a half mile thick, man. And that was the first time that I thought about ending my life, right? I couldn't feel anymore, you know? And anyways, the next 5 years were like horrendous drug addiction. If I was already suicidal, or not suicidal, but if I was already kind of living this kamikaze lifestyle, then the thought of suicide just made it even, that was it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But it wasn't on bikes anymore. Even though I was still trying to function as a motorcycle stunt rider, I was that story you read about in every horrible, you know, rock star drug addict type of bio, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In the closet, you know, before I started that, there was money, there was all this stuff. And the first year, even 36 years old, that's it. You think you have it. You can handle it. I was still functioning. I was a functioning alcoholic. I was a functioning drug addict. But then boom, you know, there was a point, one specific point where I was like, I got to stop this. But then I couldn't. I was an addict, completely, full-blown. And so those 4 years were, that's another episode, man.
Yeah.
You know, and I really would like to dig into that because I think one of the things that people need to know is how bad it really was. But if we're going to go there, we're going to go there properly. Like, I was in the depths of hell and addiction and the suffering, and my kids and my wife and those around me, just it's chilling, you know. And the amount of drugs and alcohol were, you know, were horrible, right? Even doctors today or whatever professionals say, there's no way. You know, they say, they argue that I couldn't possibly take that much. I was, man. You know what I mean? And but anyways, it all fell down, you know. And one of my buddies says, you know, the devil raises you up so he can just drop you right on your head.
So it's a harder fall.
You know? Yep. And it takes you up so high, you know. And so suddenly those lawyers aren't sponsoring me anymore. You know, the money's starting to run out.
You're becoming a liability.
That's it. That's it, man. Mm-hmm. And so now the trouble's starting to stick. And of course, the one thing that the devil loves to do is he kept me blind for so long. But when I was sitting in the depths of the bucket of crap, you better believe he pulled those blinders off. You know, when you're sitting in a jail cell, when you're sitting in a courtroom, when you're sitting in the corner of a room in addiction, you know what I mean? It's the worst place you can possibly be. You'd start banging. I used to bang my head against the wall, man. And I tell that story over and over in the prisons, you know. It was, you know, when you read in the New Testament and go in there right now, it's just, you know, it talks about the stories of the legions of demons in a person that's so bad and so overwhelming that, you know, it talks about the man living in a cave, cutting himself and roaring and just like, that was me.
Yeah.
And it's real life stuff, man. So anyways, fast forward in October 4th, I come out of a court, but that was the first non-criminal court case that I came out. It was divorce court.
Yeah.
And I still had one bottle of Xanax, full bottle of Xanax at home. Like, I used to get hundreds a month, but I was done, man. I was completely done with my life. I didn't see any hope. That no doctors worked, no drugs worked, no alcohol, nothing the world had to offer worked. I tried everything. I had the money to try everything. I had the money to have the best psychiatrists and psychologists in the area, and all they did was make me worse. But once again, thank you for getting me there. Because here, I'm on my mom's couch, and I'm done, man. I'm getting ready to end my life. I was waiting for her to go to bed, and I went to a meeting, and it's the first time that I physically heard the Lord speak to me. And this young man that was speaking was talking, and he actually never saw him in my life. He actually pointed to me, and it was my dad's voice. Mm-hmm. And he said, if you're not willing to put God in your life, then said some other stuff, which isn't important. And I'm just kind of chopping this story up a little bit. The fact of the matter was, I knew there was something else out there. It was driving me crazy. So my thought went from suicide to something's out there. That was my dad, right? Yeah. And I find out later as a believer that God uses people in mysterious ways, you know what I mean? And once again, I was on the mom, fast forward a couple hours, I was on my mom's couch still contemplating the suicide, but I had this thought of there was something else out there. The only other thing I heard this young man talk about was him giving his life over to God. And here it was my dad through him that told me there's a way out.
Yeah.
And I was a complete drug addict. I was facing 6 years over in Pennsylvania for some stuff. I was walked out of divorce court that morning. Couldn't come within 500 feet of anything that knew me. It was every drug. It was gallons of alcohol a night, like probably a gallon to 2 gallons. Like, it was crazy. But anyways, you know, I was trembling and shaking on my mom's couch. And man, I didn't even know how to do it. But I just said, God, if you exist, then stop me from taking my life. You know, that was my sinner's prayer then. I didn't even know what the sinner's prayer was. And I said, help me. And I feel it right now, and I'll never lose that feeling. And it's when he embraces me, right? And a lot happened that night. That's, like I said, there's a part two to this, man, that we can get into, like, the complete score of the whole, you know, transformation. But I was in God's hands when I came. And I tell people, I don't know if I went to heaven or heaven was brought to me, but God pulled back the veil on life that separates us from him. And he showed me and I was in his presence. And even the next morning, I was glowing. My mom was like, what happened? She didn't even know what went down. She's like, what happened, Scotty? I said, I don't know. I just know I'm in God's hands. And she said, praise the Lord, praise the Lord. People weren't allowed to say that around me, but it was just, she saw this. And, you know, reading in the Bible, there's a lot of parts and situations where people glow after they see God, you know? So anyways, and I wish to say it was all easy from then on, but, you know, you're talking.
I was going to ask, like, what did life become like for you now that you had Christ?
You know, I was filled with the Spirit, they call it the Holy Spirit. I didn't know what that meant, but this tremendous weight was lifted off me. I didn't know what Jesus did on the cross. I didn't know he took all the sin. All I know is I just cried out to him and I appeared to him. And then that morning I was reborn, right? I didn't know what reborn even meant. I just know that I was going to commit suicide the 12 hours before or 8 hours before. And now I feel like I'm walking like Fred Flintstone when, you know, when he used to bowl and he'd do that twinkle toe thing. That was me, man. I'm going like tweet, 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 tweet. And then here my mom stumbles on me because I was walking through the hallway and she recognizes it. And it was just like this, there's this innocence, but all that burden was taken.
Yeah.
All that weight was taken off my shoulders, right? But I really didn't know what to do with it. Like, long story short, you know, I was still facing those charges. I still couldn't talk to my wife. I still couldn't see my kids. You know, I was still going through court cases. I was usually on probation in a couple states at a time, not just one. I think I was, no, that was wild. But, you know, we're talking about the wedding. I was on probation for that for a while. But anyways, you know, it was just a miracle. I didn't know miracles existed. I always thought it was for somebody else or just fairy tales or something like that. But here I'm living it. But now the problem was, what do I do? Right?
Yeah. And then, you know, I know like some of the problems that I've, you know, I had experienced is like there's your circle that's used to you being one way. And then all of a sudden, and it scares a lot of people, and they don't want to.
You better believe it. I had death threat. You know, when I went, it's sad. There was 2 years there. I don't want to say they were the most difficult 2 years of my life, but they were definitely challenging. I say it was Scott walking in the desert. There was a moment where Jesus was called to the desert, right? And, you know, the devil did not want to lose me. He almost had me.
Yeah.
And that's the thing with people that are first changing their life or committing it over to Christ. They got to realize, and this is why we come beside them, you know, right away, you know, that there was a pact between you and the devil. It was blood in, death out, right? And so for me, you know, he was trying to get me to stick with that game plan. So although we have the protection of God and I was in his hands and I felt the presence of his angels, I was meant to take a ride for those 2 years trying to discover who he was. And also,
in a humbling process.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, the humility was just, but it's not too hard to find humility when you're, you know, a 90-pound ex-drug addict on your mom's couch that lost everything. You know, that was part of the process that needed to happen with me. I had to be stripped of everything, right? So, you know, in a sense, you know, I just started this journey alone, but with God. That's the thing that was important. I knew he existed now, and I knew I could communicate with him. I felt him. I felt his presence. I think everybody can feel his presence. I think people will feel his presence even if you don't acknowledge him. The amount of presence you're going to feel is depending on who you're serving. He was always trying to tap me on the shoulder. And our listeners, like if you've been down and out, if you're an atheist or you're on drugs or whatever, he's there. He was always there. And that's the one thing I preach about, you know, especially at addiction places or in prisons. I say, you know, Christ was there when you're getting high, you know, when you were, you know, stealing from your children, when you were in court or when you were committing that crime. He's always there. It's just a matter of that surrender. And it takes the ultimate, you know, decision to become humble. Or, like me, to be stripped of it and find yourself completely broken So once again, it was the best place in a place that I needed to get to. So I can look back at all those dysfunctional things. Not that I would want to do it again, but it is what God has based our ministry around, right? And yeah, the people that we're reaching.
Yeah, and I wanted to start talking about that. Before, you know, the idea of the ministry and building this ministry, the reconciliation with your family, you know, how did that go about? You had to do some proving.
Oh, man, you know, right? It's only by the grace of God, right? As a drug addict, you burn all those bridges. You're fortunate to even get to talk to your children again, or if your wife even stuck around, you know. But the thing that caught everybody by surprise when I could start communicating again was I said something that people weren't allowed to say. And they either knew it was true or thought I completely lost my mind. But I said, I'm in God's hands now. And people were like, what? Because they knew I was such an atheist. And they believed me because I was sober, right? So once again, the thing that I always tell people is the action is the most important part, right? A lot of people will give their lives to Christ, but then they just sit and wait. Yeah. He is not UPS. He's not going to deliver over and over unless you take action, yeah, right?
Don't just say it, do it.
That's it. That's it, man. So, you know, fortunately, the way I was strong, and this is, I believe, why God picked me, is because, you know, once I got back on my feet, He knew that I was going to be full steam ahead, and He knew I'd be all in. I always was all in. Since I saw Evel Knievel, I was all in for riding. Whatever else I did in my life, you know, snowboarding or skateboarding, I was all in, man. Boom, that's it. You know, even some of the bad things in my life, I was all in drugs, all in crime, all in whatever, you know. But anyways, that was an advantage. So if you're wired like that, you know, if you're a great drug dealer, you're going to be a great servant of the Lord. If you're great at stealing cars, you're going to be great at serving the Lord and helping others stop stealing cars, you know. So some of those things that the world will say are dysfunctional were actually is what and how God is going to use you when you give your life to Him, right? So, and even for me, I'm fortunate that He still lets me ride. And I believe the only reason He lets me ride is because I was willing to give it up.
Yeah.
Right? I didn't say, well, I'm going to serve you as long as I can keep my bikes. And that's even to mental. I'm done. You can have it all. I'll drive. And even to this day, if God ever wants me to take this truck and trailer and drive it off a cliff, you better believe I'm driving off the cliff without questioning Him. For the first time in my life, I stopped questioning Him. But I started praying for mighty men of God to surround me. And this was another key part of my life. Yeah. Right? I said, you know, I was trying to fumble. I picked up a Old Testament, which is a wrong place for a new believer to start, right? Yeah, and so I didn't know. You know, I started talking to some people. But anyways, it was through prayers that all my answers started coming to me, right? So anyways, you know, there's a lot in those 2 years to be talked about. But once again, just to get through.
Yeah, unfortunately, we'll have to. I mean, fortunately, because I definitely want to get with you and get more in depth and do more of the story, but time restraints and whatever.
Sure.
You know, we gotta.
So basically, I'm going to sum up where I was at. You know, I just became faithful. I became a prayer warrior, and I hate that term, like when it's used loosely. I pray, man. I pray. Sometimes I would pray for hours and hours, you know, and I started reading the Bible, but then I started praying for the things that I knew I needed. Because I knew how to be a successful businessman. If you want to be, I knew how to be a successful stunt rider. Or everybody knows this. If you want to be successful at anything, what do you pray for? You pray for people to surround you that have done it and doing it better.
Yeah.
Right?
Mentors.
That's right. And so that's what it turned into. It turned into discipleship. I got from point A to point B, which was all miracles that were just starting to line up. But every morning I woke up, I gave my life over to Him. And every morning He answered. And it's the one thing I tell inmates. I said, you can be guaranteed two things in the morning. The devil's going to be at the foot of your bed wanting to put you right back to where you were or keep you in this cell for the rest of your life. But Christ is right beside your bed with His hand out, you know, probably weeping because of the day before. But He's still there saying, come with me today. And that guy will have no power. So that's how I live my life every day, yeah. Right?
Every day is a new beginning. Which way are we going to go?
That's it, man. Mm-hmm. So prayer, I started receiving visions. He started communicating with me. And it's not like a burning bush thing in my backyard and it's like the tree starts talking. It's just, and I think most people have these feelings. It's just passion, this desire that's just strange. Really? Yeah. That you can't shake. That's God. That's how God speaks to me. He put the vision of Ride for Life. I said, how am I going to serve Jesus? Do I go back to school? I didn't even think about the bikes being a part of it. What can I do with Jesus on a bike?
So I need to get away from that. That was the trouble.
Yeah, that's right. You know what I mean? As for the friends, they were trying to drag me back in, but I put my foot down at a certain point, and I walked away from everybody. Except my, when God put me back with my wife and my kids and my mom and those that truly loved me for who I was, that was it, man. And everybody hated me for that, persecuted me for that, lied about me, you know, tried to say that, you know, Scott's on this thing or working an angle, this, and that's what the devil does. Yeah. Unfortunately, it's a promise that's in the Bible itself, right? So anyways, I just stayed faithful. Mighty men of God started surrounding me, and then these visions started coming, right? And the visions were in the form of, okay, it was one day at a time. Scotty, I'm going to send you this mission. And it was people from my past that we've done shows for before that lost loved ones. The first one was in North Carolina. This couple, we used to go down to a track down there. Their daughter died of a drug overdose. She was 16 years old. And they said, Scotty, we need you down here. And this is when I was praying. What do I do, God? What do I do? And he said, take your bike. I've saved you. Go tell the world. Simple as that. And I didn't even know how to do that. I didn't even have a truck back then, right? But I stopped worrying about tomorrow because I knew he was answering, he was directing me. And then the whole Ride for Life thing came just like, you know, in a vision, talking to some of these elders in my life. God is telling me to go. And now he's sending people to request me to bring a bike and then stop to talk to the kids.
Yeah.
Right? And it was a family that already, it was too late for them. But anyways, that's how it started. And then we went and did that one. And the hardest thing I ever did in my life was ride a bike and then jump off of it and expose everything dirty about myself. But the second show we did, I felt purpose. One man fell into my arms and just cried. And it made... For the first time, I was probably 43 years old at that time. And the first time in my life, I truly felt purpose. I already felt God's love. But then now I know what I need to do for the rest of my life. And it's the best thing I could possibly ever want to do. Right?
Yeah.
And it's crazy. And that's why I talk to anybody that's in a horrible place right now. Every one of those horrible places I ever was in, God has used to reach an individual. To help save them and bring them to Christ, whether it's about not feeding my kids when I was high or whether it was about the police. It's just crazy.
It's a relatable thing for whatever that person's going through. You went through what you did so you could have the tool to relate and connect with somebody that's going through it now.
Correct. You know? And some of those things were the worst things imaginable. When I get into the prison context, I keep it 100% real. And the stories, like I said... some of them are hard to put on blast like this, but I was in the hell on earth, right, for a long time. And I had the means and the money to do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But once again, those stories is why 100, 200, 300 inmates will raise their hand to change their life, right?
Yeah.
Out of my dysfunction. And that's what we've been talking about for the last month, from tragedy to triumph, right? So we can take that tragedy and turn it into triumph through God. But if we don't give it to God, like my story, if I wouldn't have done what I did on October 4th, then it would remain tragic because I wouldn't be here. I'd have been dead.
Yeah. Well, we're running short on time, unfortunately. But I wanted to ask you a few of the questions that I normally ask my guests on here. Well, first of all, like if people want to know more about the ministry, where do they look? Where would they?
We are, our website is rideforlife.bike, and it's the number 4, ride4life.bike. And I'm all over Facebook, right? So Scott Caribulad. I have a page on there. We have Ride for Life Official. And in all honesty, there's probably, you know, people from, we did a little broadcast this morning. There's people on there probably right now, you know. So that's the one thing I encourage. You know, if you're in a dark place right now, reach out. Reach out. That's part of that humility thing.
Yeah.
It's okay. It's okay.
Ask for help.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So you can reach me on Facebook. We have an Instagram page, or you can reach us at our website.
Okay. Now, during all your travels, where's one of the your favorite places that you ever visited?
Wow. Man, you know, I fell in love with all, you know, I did, especially early on when we traveled, you know, I wasn't a complete idiot and out of my mind. I just appreciate it. I wish I could have go back to some of those places, but I mean, every place that we went was surreal. You know, I loved, you know, Canada, Toronto. We did a lot of stuff in Toronto. I love L.A. We did a lot of stuff in L.A. and Long Beach area. But there's totally two different, you know what I mean, worlds.
Yeah.
You know, we used to do a lot of stuff in Miami and the Florida scene and the beaches down there. We did a lot of filming down there in the Keys and stuff like that. We did a lot of stuff in Jamaica. We did a lot of stuff in England and Scotland, and it's weird. It's kind of like beautiful, but you wouldn't want to stay there too long. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, but each place that we went, because I was raised right and I just lost it, I still always tried to stop to take it in. You know, if we were in Northern Cali, I would go, and some of my business partners at the time would make fun of me. I would always schedule the airplane to take off a day later, right? And they used to get mad at me, whatever, or get high or whatever. Anyways, you know, I wanted to see the sights and the Golden Gate Bridge and Alcatraz, and, you know, same thing, you know, going to LA. But, you know, just driving through this country is so beautiful. We spent a lot of time in New York City. You know, New York City is just an amazing place that, so favorite is, you know, I don't have a favorite. I always appreciated, you know, I did appreciate just the diversity and just the beauty of, you know, wherever we were at, you know.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, not very long though.
So favorite toy as a child and why?
Oh man, you know, I would have to say, you know, and it's cool because I get to relive some of this with my kids today. And, you know, I was just getting the Christmas stuff out as you came over today, right? So, and we have a four-year-old, and, you know, the older one's not so much. But, and I tell those stories, man. Like, some of the highlights were I did have an Evel Knievel BMX bike, and I got it for Christmas, you know what I mean? I did have the Evel Knievel wind-up thing that used to jump ramps. The one that really was probably my favorite was this thing called Whirly Bird, and it was this little helicopter that was attached to a wire, and you had two controls, and this is like 70s stuff, so was like amazing. But this thing you'd fire it up and it would hover and it would go around, and you would try to pick it. Had a little grappling hook, man. I actually looked for one of those on eBay because I wanted to get it to play with it again. But so that would probably be my first. Second would probably be slot cars. I used to love slot cars.
Oh, cool. And then any message that you have for our military members currently serving overseas?
One of the highest honors in my past life, and now we're still living through it, but one of the highest honors is, as crazy as I was, we had a lot of military-based fans from all over. And they would send us letters of appreciation, and we would send them T-shirts and the wrong shirts, of course. But we still always tried to support them because a lot of the guys ride, right? A lot of guys, you know, when they get home or even in the state here, they have sport bikes. So we had a huge military fan base, and one time they actually dedicated a mission to the Star Boys.
Nice.
Right. And I got the chills, and I still, you know, a lot of the stuff from my past life is packed away and gone. But this particular thing was probably one of the top 10 greatest moments of my past life. So they dedicated this mission. The flag that was on one of the lead Humvees was folded and was sent with this plaque that says we dedicated mission such and such on behalf of the Star Boys, just keeping their morale up. Because although, you know, there was a sense of good entertainment that we brought, you know what I mean? And those, we would send them videos, VHS at the beginning and DVDs, and they would watch them overseas, you know? So now I'm actually dealing with a lot of the military guys that are struggling. Yeah. Right. So we're still just as involved. And a lot of those guys that looked up the Star Boys back then are now finding out my story now because, you know, obviously the post-traumatic stress that's coming from the military is real.
Self-medicating.
Yeah. You know? And we talk about suicide. Suicide is real. It's real within our teens. It's real within our military. And it's real with our civilians. So, you know, I encourage anybody, you know, just now. It's unbelievable because my heart is so softened and just so open. Like I spend most of my day just in awe and in appreciation. And obviously when the military always will pay, it's something that, you know, I never had enough guts to do. And so, and I had a lot of guts, you know, but I truly appreciate the protection and the service that they offer me, as well as, which is crazy to say, law enforcement. You know what I mean? Yeah. Because I regard, they're protecting us, right? Mm-hmm. Both of them. One in the local scale, one in the global scale. But, you know, I have, as much as I was against the law enforcement, I always make it a point to go up and I'll apologize. And they'll be like, what do you apologize? I'm like, and then they're like, oh man, that was so long ago. But I, it just breaks my heart. So anyways, man, just my hat goes off. And especially now, what I have to offer is if any military is struggling with something, I have the answer, man. I do, you know, and I've been set free of that burden. I used to bang my head, you know, a bad situation and witnessing bad things. It all has the same result. Yeah. And there's only one solution in my mind, you know, so I put that out there.
Great. And then one last thing before we wrap up, would you be willing to do a promo ID for the show?
Sure.
All right. I got a card for you, so.
Introducers, this is Scott Caribouled, and you are listening to Today's Boondoggle on Domain Cleveland Radio.
Awesome. Thank you.
Hey, that was good. I've messed several of those up with other, you know, places. You know, one, I just had to walk away. I'm like, I can't do this.
Boondoggle throws people off. That's why I made a card.
Yeah, that's
like
good.
I try and tell them, and they're like, what? And we go back and forth. So I have to write it down. So now I just made cards to make it easier.
Awesome.
So, Scott, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We will do a part two. We will get together because there's so much more to your story that needs to be heard. Unfortunately, you know, we scheduled this in, and I got to run.
Yeah, but, you're a busy man.
Yeah. But thank you for the time, and man, I'm glad to know you, call you a friend.
Awesome. Thank you so much, bro.
Purpose on your plane. Don't say a last prayer because I
For tuning into this week's edition of Today's Boondoggle. Domain Cleveland Entertainment is a veteran-owned and operated entertainment cornucopia of nonsensical shenanigans. You can find interesting interviews, music news, entertainment information, and just about everything else in between. Thank you again for tuning into the show here at Domain Cleveland.